bodies reduces the risk of getting or transmitting the virus. And booster doses help reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19. For better protection against the virus, book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine and follow the recommended vaccination schedule. Vaccination against COVID-19, a good way of extending our protection. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening, good day. Welcome to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, your show, 1 hour show on African current affairs. I am sitting here virtually with Doug. Doug, what do you have lined up for us today, tonight?
Well, Raj Kanji, our good friend and comrade in New Brunswick, introduced me to the work of the late Dan Matera, who passed away in early July. And he was a very important activist, poet, and journalist in South Africa. From the 50s on, he was very, very busy man and involved in politics at so many levels. And when he passed away, Raj got in touch with his son. They had set up a Dan Matera Legacy Foundation. And so that's what we're going to hear tonight, is an interview with Raj and Dr. Teddy Matera, Don's son. And it's a wonderful insight into a historical period, into the confluence of art and activism, and also a comment on the current society of South Africa. So Raj and Don will go through that. And they're going to talk about Sophia Town, a time when in the early 50s, when things were really active in South Africa and the Black community, the music scene was huge with the divas like Miriam Makeba, Leta Mbulu, Dorothy Msuku, Dolly Mtebe, and Drum Magazine. But they'll get into it from Dan's perspective. And it's I think, going to be fun for everybody to hear. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Tapi tapi kino, no haya meti alelesi. Naga kiji tapi tapi kino, no haya meti alelesi.
We're here this evening, friends and comrades, ladies and gentlemen, on Amandla with Raj Kanji in Sackville, New Brunswick, and with Teddy Matera, Dr. Teddy Matera, who's in South Africa. And Raj, I'll let you lead this tribute to Don Matera, because you're the one that introduced the subject to me, and I'm fascinated to hear much more about his life and his work.
Okay. Welcome, Ted Matera. He is the son of Don Matera. Ted is a filmmaker and a lecturer and a and on the Don Matera, vice chairperson of the Don Matera Foundation. Now, Don Matera was an activist from the ghetto in South Africa. He was born in 1935 and died on 18th of July, 2022. This segment is to commemorate his life and struggles for human dignity, struggle against the brutal apartheid regime. The ghetto was Sophiatown. It was on the fringes of Johannesburg, the hub of gold mining city. The ghetto consisted of poor and rich, scrooches mixed with caring and sensitive people, priests and gangsters, politicians and pimps, shabins and churches. This melting pot forged a culture of resistance and above all, a rich tapestry of arts, music, of literature, of poetry, of theater. This is not to romanticize ghetto life. It is a retrospective joy, a joy of human connectedness, a human quality of compassion that can exist even in the worst of times. So hello and welcome, Ted. And perhaps we can start by you giving us some kind of history and upbringing of Don in the ghetto and paint, give us a picture of the tapestry that existed at that time.
So just to lend you quickly a bit of background to how the Materas came into being. My great-grandfather Paolo from Napoli jumped on a merchant ship and in the early 1900s, and I think my guess is that he probably didn't know where he was going to go and land up. And he ended up in Port Elizabeth, Cape Town, and then Port Elizabeth. And as the story goes, according to my dad, obviously, who's a dramaturgist at heart, says that the minute Paolo came off the ship, he saw this woman who was doing the washing for sailors. And they fell in love, you know. They couldn't speak each other's language. They had no idea what they were saying. But I think, you know, it's an amazing thing that we know that love can do, is that it can transcend. And in that amazing way, that's how we met my great-grandmother, Emini, which means in isiXhosa, the morning, right? So, and they called her Mini as a result, but then the full name was Emini. And they traveled through, she was a coy Xhosa princess, and then he went to ask for her hand in marriage, and on a horse and cart, they traveled through Durban and later back to Johannesburg and moved into Sophiatown. And Don was then the product of our great-grandfather's son. I think if I remember correctly, he speaks very fondly in his book called Memories, the Weapon, about going to school in KwaZulu-Natal at a boarding school. And at 8 years old on the train, he was sent there by himself. And he had a board with a string tied to it that says, "My name is Don Matera. I am 8 years old. And I'm off to St. Catharines in Natal. Please do not hurt me." And what an image. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he writes a great poem called To the Felt. And at 8 years old, he casts his first poem to paper. His return from boarding school saw him living with his Motswana grandmother. The Tswanas are a clan in South Africa, Southern Africa, in fact, until later his grandfather, Paolo, adopts him as his own son. And Donato Francesco Matera is his Italian names, and Munna Pula, which means man of the rain, is his Tswana name, his African name. He was born in December, like I am. And in South Africa, as you know, Raj, it's the rainy season for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have these dug, we have these drops of rain that are bigger than pennies. They're warm and hot, and they fall on the window, and you walk in the rain in Johannesburg because it's almost like a blessing of sorts, you know.
Right.
And so Don then proceeds, and the street life calls him, and he becomes the leader of a gang called the Vultures. And as things would happen to him, he gets involved in that violence and that upsurge until he's arrested in 1962. And while he's being arrested, Sophia Town is broken down where he lives. And this is what he writes. Shall I go ahead?
That'd be so interesting to hear it.
It's called The Day They Came for Our House, Sophia Town, 1962. The sun stood still in the sullen wintry sky, a witness to the impending destruction. Armed with bulldozers, they came to do a job, nothing more, just hired killers. We gave way. There was nothing we could do. Although the bitterness stung in us, in the place we knew to be part of us, and in the earth around, we stood. Slow, painfully slow, clumsy crushers crawled over the firm pillars into the rooms that held us and the roof that covered our heads. We stood. Dust clouded our vision. We held back our tears. It was over in minutes. Done. Bulldozers have power. They can take apart in a few minutes all that had been built over the years and raised over generations. The power to destroy, the pain of being destroyed, dust. That's the poem he looks back into about the pain of Sophia Town being razed to the ground. And people, as you said, Doug, get moved to different townships, and they begin the classification of racism in South Africa. Those of mixed blood are called coloreds, and they are sent to different areas. Those of African descent are sent into Soweto. And those of Indian descent are called sent into places like Lanesia and different parts in the country. And that was the history. And so in the 70s, he looks at himself and he decides that gangsterism is no more for him. And he joins the Black Consciousness Movement, which was formed by Steve Biko, Seth Scooper, and a number of other people, I'm sure that Raj can attest to.
On that point, Ted, was that, you know, you in gangsterism, it was very simple. I mean, as he describes it, right, that,
yes,
you know, you knew your enemies and your friends.
Yes.
Once for political consciousness, it's quite different, right? It's very nuanced. The violence unleashed by the state and the way you respond to that violence is of a different order. They require a different type of political consciousness. Can you explain how we graduated into that mode, you know?
You know, I spent a lot of time with my dad because we are both of that creative ilk, you know, we share that passion. And if I recall what that meant, you know, as you said, I think gangsterism requires some kind of order to it. And he was at the crucible, at the peak of that, because he was the leader of this gang. And I think once he had reached that pinnacle, and as he comes out of prison, I think he called it an awakening. He realized that this could no more hold true for who he had become, who he was, the new Don that was born. It was no longer the, you know, in Italian, the Don, as you know,
right, right,
the leader, right? So that a new dawn is born. And he actually, strangely enough, alluded to a new dawn as opposed to a dawn, you know, that a new dawn had come. And And I think, as you rightfully say, that the country, if you remember, the 60s was a barren period in the South African history, political history. The ANC had been banned, the PAC had been banned, the Communist Party was banned. A number of leaders went into exile, and the golden age of apartheid was raised over South Africa. So the 70s brought and filled this vacuum. And I think Don started off first in the Labour Party, which was a kind of concoction of parties that the South African government had allowed. And I think fairly shortly afterwards, he meets people like Seth Scooper and Steve Biko, who are part of the Black Consciousness Movement. And they rope him into this movement that speaks to a new identity, no longer a gangster identity, but an identity that announces the awakening of Black people in South Africa, you know, towards a consciousness that announced the freedom, essentially. That's what I read into it, Raj.
But he, you know, he was part of the ANC Youth League, and that was in the 50s, right?
That was in the 50s, yes.
That's right. And then he, there's the ANC codifies the struggle in the Freedom Charter, and that only occurs in 1955, right?
Yes.
And then he moves, you know, just to give us an understanding of how he moves from, there was unhappiness about being in the ANC at that time because by the PAC, and they yes. felt not enough was being done, right? And for me, like, there was this period where lots of different political leanings were bearing down on what was happening in the townships, right?
Right.
The point is, what makes a person move from point A to point B in their political consciousness, right? From one yes. particular affiliation to the other. And what was the happening on the ground that made people to change in that way?
Yes, I think like I said, you know, and that you mentioned, the apartheid regime takes on a brutal campaign. You know, in Sharpeville in 63, they mow down 69 people. They get shot in the back as they're running away, right, against the pass mm-hmm. laws. In the late 60s, again, we see a sort of new sort of a plateau of apartheid leaders that come into the rise. And I think with that came this new understanding. Remember that things don't happen in isolation. In the US, the civil rights movement had come up. Right. What had happened yeah. was a lot of people were starting to get yeah. influenced about a new kind of Africanism, a new right. kind of Black identity. And mm-hmm. I think if you look at the synergistic relationship between what Biko was saying, what Malcolm X had said, what Stokely Carmichael was talking about, what the Black mm-hmm. Panther movement was talking about, there was this sort of link across the waters, you know, yes. instead of that transatlantic slavery, yes. here comes the reverse of that, and it announces a new sense of being. And I think that was really key in how things began to change in the country. The train strike in Durban in 1973 was a big pivotal period, because yes. the first time South African workers decide that they're going to strike against the state. Yes. And this grows across the country, and it sort of gets sparked and fired into 1976. Don, in 1974, if I'm not mistaken, or 73, converts to Islam.
Right.
And another new awakening begins for him around claiming an identity which was not part of the Christian identity, which was essentially connected to the colonial construct in a way. And but he changed sides.
Yet it's that, you know, he mentions that his pivotal influence was Father Trevor Huddleston, right? In terms of
yes.
turning that key in his mind that, you know, this has to happen. Yet Can you explain how that key turns in his turn towards Islam? Was it, you know, what happened in the US with the likes of Malcolm X?
He says upon his conversion to Islam that, you see, you're absolutely right. I think he mentions in the documentary that I made recently, I'd interviewed him last year, and he says, Father Trevor Huddleston comes to him and he says to him, and he points his finger into his heart, where his heart is, and he says, you have to change your ways. And he says, you need to change who you are. And he says, what should I change to? And he says, change your heart.
Right.
You know, and I think that was, you know, the way he spoke about that was so, you see, Don was not partisan to any religion. I think he had personally embraced Islam, but he knew the Bible inside out. I mean, he constantly took us to Psalm 103 and 105 and talked about David and Abraham and Solomon as if, you know, there were stories in his youth, you know. So I think going to Islam, as you know, many of the civil rights leaders at the time, including Muhammad Ali for that matter, Malcolm X, you know, Elijah Muhammad, a whole series of African Americans adopt Islam. Malcolm X himself goes to Saudi Arabia and he comes back a changed man. Instead of talking about the blue-eyed devil, he talks about every person being his brother. So I think those were really instrumental changes in his life, because I think Islam kind of presented this kind of unification of one God in a way for him. You know, that's how I understood what he had meant by it, you know. We talked extensively about this, by the way, because I'm a Buddhist, you see, and okay. We kind of had our normal kind of, you know, challenges around
that.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. And that's interesting, is that he's that certain conditions shape your consciousness, right?
And at a particular time.
Time. That's right. And the question is, you know, when do you transcend? You know, when it's a dynamic situation. You move from one consciousness to the other, depending on the conditions that you're living in, right? And yes. And I was quite curious to know that, well, I was listening to an interview with Ibrahim Harvey, and he was saying, well, he was having the same kind of discussions about why did he turn to Islam, right? And
right.
There's a broader economic imperatives that can also shape and understand the struggles in the global context, right?
Yes.
Now, you know, when all this is happening, right, he makes another radical, he's so involved in the struggle and goes on that with the banning that happens in 73 to 82.
Yes.
We realize that he can't go to meetings. He can't go, you know.
It was a painful time in our family. He was banned, you know, house arrested, for those who don't know. Many other leaders had been restricted to their homes where they couldn't, you know. Don had worked as a journalist and suddenly was restricted to a home where he could only see one person at a time. And for us, as his children, I was 13 at the time, he would see people anyway, you know, break that rule anyway. People would jump over the fence at the back of our house, you know, and sneak through the back door, and we would have to stand outside. We had a whistle in our family, you know, like,
yeah.
You know that the police are coming, because we would walk around, you know, like pretend we were loitering the street corners, but we knew the security police cars, you know them, Raj. They were
right,
kind of just, you could see them from a mile away, that old Datsun without the wheel caps, you know.
Yes.
Gigi. And then you'd see these like guys in their safari suits. I mean, they stood out so painfully. I don't know right. how they thought we would know who so they were.
Haircut, you know? Too.
Yes. Well, actually, yeah. I was actually in a meeting with him during his banning period. You know, it was something where they were the government was going to close one of the universities to African students. So we had gone out around the country to canvass support, and yes. he broke that banning
order,
and he was in this meeting. And by the next morning, the security branch was at my place, but I had left already. And the most hated guy was this Haystack. I don't know if you remember.
He brought terror and fear, that man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Him and a guy called Roy something, meaning red. I forget his name now. You know, they would break the door down sometimes. And I remember, you remember Raj Don was a boxer in his youth.
Yes, right.
And, you know, when they come in, he would, one or two of them would be lying on the floor, you know, until they sort of all tackled him. He had a serious right hook, you know.
Right.
None of that passing stuff.
He was Panikasi.
Yeah, he was Panikasi, you know. Yeah. And, you know, Brazinga was his name. So
yeah.
they used to call his right hook, Doug, they used to call it the Zinga Special. You know, like, you know, and during his gangster days, he would say, shall I give him the special? And he would sort of shadow box, you know, and the guys would say, give him the special. And, you know, he would drop a guy and he'd be out for a couple of minutes, you know. And Don took these guys on, you know.
Right. And I remember, like, the description. This is what makes it so colorful there, was that we used to see the similar thing, like, you know, when the cops coming in and somebody will give them a blow and say, and the words would say, yeah, ek het daai ou daai kort broek opsy.
That's a long
time. Yeah, so the guy with the short trousers, because all the cops, usually the police wore short trousers, right?
Yeah.
It's a tanner and her drugs, the teeth were blown in, you know. So the
yeah.
So those were the descriptions, and I mean, it's a language that
rich. I mean, rich.
Yes, you know, yeah, yeah.
It spoke about pain, but in such a way that it was almost ironic in its beauty, you know.
Yeah.
So that was I mean, it was a strange time. I just recently he had asked for his files because the government had finally opened up the secret files for ex-political prisoners to get them from the security branches. And you know, in there was the whole sort of documentation of the torture and who had tortured him at the time. You know, he had been hung upside down like so many different people while he was arrested more than 50, 60 times, I believe, you know. And they did what they did to a lot of people, you know, including one of Don's friends that died, Raj, whom they threw down. What was his name again? From not Steve Biko, but the other. His case was recently settled last year.
Yes, yes, yes.
Amatimol, you know.
Yes.
Okay. And I remember Uncle Ahmad in my childhood, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Asvat also, you know.
Yes.
My dad would take me to them when we were ill, you know. Those were great people. And you know, Don knew these people, as you know, the Salujis, all of those people quite personally, you know. So our home was a kind of breeding ground, you know, so you could never really escape. I remember, you know, I could read when I was 4 years old because I used to sit on his lap. And you know, he was a journalist then, and he would write, you'd see in, you know how newspapers, articles are written, sources said and sources claim. And so I would say to Don, are sources claimed and sources said, are they related, you know? And he would laugh at me about it, you know. Don was great as a dad. He made us learn. Oh, it was painful sometimes as a child when you wanted to go and play soccer, you know. Uh-huh. He would make us learn 3 new words every day from every letter of the alphabet. So today it would be from A, and then tomorrow you go to B, you learn 3 new words, and then by the end of the year you had learned, and you need to know how to use them, you know. So it was beautiful, you know, living in a home like that, you know.
So that richness of that, creating that milieu in the townships of wanting to learn when you know the schools were not providing that. Yes. Similarly with the music, can you tell us more about, for instance, his relationship with Hugh Masekela? You know, Trevor Huddleston again is the
instrumental, you know, yes. Instrumental in that. I mean, Don and Hugh were friends in a really amazing kind of way. It's almost like a movie. He had saved Hugh Masekela's life twice, I believe, you know. When gangsters wanted to rob him in Sophia Town, they literally had the knife at his throat while he was on the ground. And Don came in and threatened to do what he needed to do if they didn't let him go. And, you know, when Brahiu came back, you know, you could see that whenever they sat together, there was something about those people from Sophia Town, all of them, you know. They spoke about Sophia Town as if, you know, some of them had died after it was razed to the ground. You know, it was
right.
They were pining over that time. You know, what a beautiful time it must have been. I was not born at the time, so.
Okay, Okay,
Relationship. And I learned jazz from Don, you know. I'm a big jazz fan, so. He would make me shine his shoes, you know, Raj, the Florsheims.
Oh, the Florsheims.
I don't know if you know Florsheim shoes, Doug,
yes.
We'd have to shine the Florsheim shoes and clean the white stitch around it.
Yeah.
And in the background, he would play Miles Davis or Johnny Hodges or Rusty Bryant or Duke Ellington. And in a strange way,
yeah,
you know, I didn't realize that this guy was educating me, you know. Right. It just seemed like incidental.
Right.
But later on,
just to go back on that shining of the shoes, we used to call that ons boni die skoene. Boni
ons boni skoene.
Yeah. So, Doug, the description is that it's got to shine so good that you got to see your face in that.
Yes.
And so the musicians, you'll notice that had that, you know, one thing that was prominent while they were playing the instrument, the shoes were the most prominent on the stage.
Immaculate.
Sorry, yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing about the gangsters, you know, they took their cue from the movies at the time. So a lot of the Sophia Town gangsters were dressed, you know, like the movie stars, you know, in America. You know, they used to order their records through the mail, I believe, you know, from New York, and their shoes would come from New York, you know. So
wow.
So that was the dad, you know. And then in the 80s, I think, you know, Raji, he then comes out with the Azanian Love Song, which was his love song for South Africa, and that was in 1983. I think he comes out with Memories, the Weapon, which is the book that he's the two books that sort of launched Don into that author's world. You know, many have been written since. I've got some here called They Passed This Way and Touched Our Lives, dedicated to the political struggle in South Africa, and Faces of Trees, which is poems of struggle, freedom, and kin. So, yeah.
You're listening to Amanda. You're on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world.
Please ask away. I'm here.
Well, I'm very fascinated by well, I'd like to go back a bit to that house of yours where there was such a movement and action and education and agitation. I mean, it's one thinks of poets as contemplative people who sit in corners and look out at the sea, but this is not that kind of thing. This is activism and the art being growing out of it.
Activism and art. It. Sure. I think that was the thing, though, you know. I mean, I think the great Chilean poet also points to that, you know, how those, you couldn't really separate the two. They were intrinsically and innately kind of bonded, you know, because people were writing poems about freedom, you know, but at the same time, talking about love of land at the same time, you know. So in our house, you know, my dad would, at that time in the 70s, when we would go to bed, you know, some of the last memories you have before you fall asleep was the sound of the typewriter, you know, going away, tick, 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 tick. Then you'd hear that thing where the typewriter comes to the end of the line and the ribbon flies across, you know. And that's those morning hours when I remember he used to spend a lot of his time writing, you know. And you know, the other part of it, you know, as Don was also a commander in the PAC, in the Pan-Africanist Congress, you know. He bought soccer kit and soccer. We started a soccer club. He started the soccer club in El Dorado Park. But like half the time, you know, you'd find the soccer ball, Raj, and you'd think, this soccer ball feels too heavy, you know? Yeah. Something's not right about this. Or you'd pick up a kit bag, you know, full of soccer kit, and you'd think, no, man, this is kind of unusually heavy. And then later on, you know, we found out that they were smuggling arms. You know, I only saw that once in my teens, where my dad came in with a brown paper bag and it was covered, you know. And then suddenly, moments after he entered the house, my mom was cooking in the house, and she was an avid Catholic, which is another story about a Muslim and a Catholic living together, you know. And the cops came in and burst through. This was when he was banned. And I just saw him give this thing to my mom. And before you knew it was gone, it was in the oven, and she did something and pretended like she was baking something. So I think they must have followed him and seen that he was carrying something, but it somehow disappeared in the kitchen, you know. I only asked him about that later, and it was an AK-47.
In the oven, cooking.
In the oven, hidden in the oven, you know.
But it's a fantastic nexus, and of course we know how much the songs of resistance as well were part of it. It's a tremendous story of art and struggle magnifying each other.
Yes, and absolutely. Now, go ahead, Raj.
So tell us, like, you know, that in that period, right, that I think it's instructive to learn that Marquez also talks about that, you know, when you're immersed in that struggle, right, then you write out of that, which is different from writing in isolation away from the, you know, and not immersed in that. And that's so striking about Don's poetry and his writings. It's so organic, it's so concrete, it's the vocabulary, it's harsh, because that reflects that reality of that times that were there. And I think the reality was, in my estimation, was even worse than that, you know, the brutality. If we had to really describe it, you know, you couldn't write about it, because the censorship was always on your head all the time. So
absolutely,
you couldn't write freely as one would have liked to, you know. Now, out of all that, he still goes on to try and overcome those restrictions. Is to he forms the COSAS, and which is the Congress of South African Writers and yes. Union of Black Journalists, again, yes. to try and get the word out to and inspire people outside of that. Can you tell us more about how that came out in came about? You know, because it was the period of harsh repression during that time.
Very much so. And I think one of the things that spoke to that, I think, you know, if one looks at the flow of his consciousness and his awakening, you know, from the child who was 8 years old to the gangster, to the guy who goes through the awakening through Black consciousness, through journalism, you know, you see that there's this kind of flow around building organization rather than just the person, the human being only, and enabling other writers, you know, who he was mentoring at the time, and he was mentored too by others too, of course, you know. And so out of the journalism comes the formation of COSO, and then there was the other organization, it slips me now, that he had formed with Joe Tlolwe and a series of other writers, AgriCluster, and those people. And I think what was critical at the time was the 80s brought in, I think 1976 announced the beginning of the end, so to speak, right? And right. I think that then sends and escalates and revitalizes communities that have been ignored. And to an extent, they are still ignored today, the so-called colored and so-called Indian communities that actually were part and parcel of the struggle, you know. So right. The struggle then spreads to Cape Town and it spreads to different places in the country. And I think Don then begins to develop and broaden his scope out using journalism, using his authorship, using his voice. And his power. I mean, one of the things that was really profound about his presence was that he was a great orator, you know. And I think mm-hmm. that also lent itself to this kind of fearlessness in which he tackles that particular period, you know. So much of that then stretches in, and you see his increased involvement and strangely underground within the PAC. I mean, we spoke about this about 5-6 years ago, about how that him becoming an operative more and more in the country, you know. And then you begin to see the division between the PAC and the more UDF type ANC leanings that come out of that period. I don't know if that answers your question, Raj, but I just sort of looked at it from that angle. You know?
That certainly you know, it's not so well publicized, that part of it in the media, and that really you know, in the end, right towards the end now, you know, you have the 94 elections, and it's now more than 20 years. And what was his feelings about what was the current situation, right? I know his word was Bra Willy Khositsile.
Khositsile, yes.
Yeah, and he was an ANC cadre, and he was disappointed, and he wrote this poem, if I can read that. He said, "Though you remain convinced to be alive, you must have somewhere to go. Your destination remains elusive."
He writes a poem, he says, it's called I See Them. This is written during the election days, right? He says, I see them. I see them every day, everywhere, non-people in non-transition, moving, shifting, going nowhere, suspended in twilight zones of vacuous expectation, waiting between nothing and nothing. I see them, I know them, I am among them, seeking veracity, but trapped on the periphery of foreign norms and values and doublespeak. So that doublespeak that you're talking about, that kind of promise that was made in the elections, you know, we're going to change the country, we're putting the people first. I mean, I don't need to tell you that, but I guess that's kind of what he's alluding to. So he continues and he says, find them not in boardrooms of decision making, nor marble halls and fine dineries, but in sanctuaries of prayer, supplicating void expense for meaning, chanting dry their flaccid lungs, emptying hearts in avid exhortation, calling on gods who are not there, not here, not anywhere. I see them, I know them, I am them, a people who have been lied to.
Wow.
So I think that captures what you were saying, Raj. You know, this was his feeling about what had happened. And I think he had seen, like so many people who probably knew it, but I think he had seen behind the mirror of promise, you know. He had seen behind that mirror. And I think what he saw, really, it scared him, you know, because he then moves away from that veneer of pretense and goes closer towards his next religion, which he calls the real religion. He says compassion is the highest religion.
Okay.
He begins to drive this compassion and takes it into children's organization. He was the patron for the National Association of Childcare Workers in South Africa with more than 220,000 people, members, right? And he starts the Don Matera School for the disabled. He starts the Don Matera School for young people in trouble with the law. And I think his disappointment somehow morphs into something else. And like I said, you look at that trajectory of his own childhood, right? The boy who was forgotten on the train now suddenly remembers the children who have been forgotten.
Yes.
You know, it's almost like a bookend in a way, you know.
Yeah.
And that
a wonderful tribute to his legacy as well.
Absolutely.
Perhaps you can just tell us a bit about the Don Matera Legacy Foundation.
Sure.
Yeah, but I can't remember Leonard Martin.
So Leonard was one of the people who dug, you know, I saw for a while in my childhood, he was there and then suddenly he was just gone. And then I end up in London 20 years later, and here's Leonard, right? And then I learned that Leonard had gone into exile because, you know, at the time, it was important not, I mean, one of the sad things about what apartheid did, it destroyed our visual curated memory. That people couldn't take photographs because if you took photos, the police would identify the people that you associated with. So a lot of meetings went undocumented. Most of them only live in people's memories, right? So Leonard was one of the people who had been under Don's wing politically for a very long time. And he then said that we should start this foundation for Don. And the foundation primarily looks after his legacy, especially his creative legacy in journalism, literature, poetry, the arts and sports. Don was an avid sports lover also. And so what we do is we are busy sort of publishing. I mean, his productivity shames me, by the way. I feel really small. We are about to publish, Raj, believe this or not, Don had written nine books in the last 7-8 years.
Wow.
Which we are now busy publishing, right? So okay. The first one's coming out in a month, which is a tribute to him. So the foundation really looks like we had our launch in 2020. We had our first inaugural lecture on the child. Like I said, Don's passion was for the child of South Africa and the world. And that inaugural lecture was addressed, our keynote speaker was Professor Jonathan Janssen, who is a renowned academic and educationist in South Africa. Let me say that.
Yeah,
Okay.
This has been an amazing time with you, Teddy. I do thank you.
I hope I've done justice, Raj.
No.
And I'm just so impressed that you lived through your father being arrested, did you say 80 times or something? It was just incredible.
But this was dead normal. Raj can testify. I mean, you know, it was dead normal for people to get arrested, picked up, dropped somewhere 20 kilometers from their home, get tortured, some would disappear and never return. You know, and that's why I find such, you know, and this is just a personal reflection, you know. I'm more than a fan of Pablo Neruda's work, you know. And when I look at Don's work and the relationship of Pablo Neruda as the part of that liberation of the Chilean struggle, yes. You know, mm-hmm. there's so much that's reflected. You know, they both have this avid love for nature and beauty of it, but they use it in such a nuanced way that, you know, if you look at Don's fascination with trees, you know, you'd drive around with him and he'd say, stop. You'd have to stop the car and get out and look at this tree. And he'd say to you, can you see the story of this tree? You know, what is it telling you? Can you see that its face is turned to the sun or the willow is looking down in shame, you know? And you know, we were on our way to go get a milkshake.
Yeah. Right.
I thought before we end, you know, I wanted to leave you with one of my favorite poems of Don's.
Please,
you still have
please.
Time, Doug.
Wonderful.
We have a really mixed heritage, you know. Our Khoi, which are some of the first indigenous peoples, and Don was the national patron of the Khoi organization. And this is a poem that you know, he it took him back to a time before history, in a way, you know. It's called We Have Been Here Before. When the first sun rose, it found us awake and waiting, long before others came to these hills. Our footsteps shaped the landscape. It tamed the buffalo and the gemsbok. We rode the wind. We silenced the hurricane. Look at us. We have been here before. We raised our temples on the shifting sands of Mali. We traded in the busy, buzzing byways of Timbuktu. And on the cobbled lanes of Memphis, our camels passed through the needle's eye. We have been here before. Our women bathed in milk and honey, covered their bodies with gold and copper dust and perfumes of myrrh and incense long before others came to our shores. We hung on the Horn of Africa. We walked through the red sands of Somalia and from the purple hills and valleys of Gondar in ancient Ethiopia. Our songs and supplications echoed across the perennial pyramids. Ah, the pyramids, those timeless, glorious symbols of African civilization. These hands, our hands, dark and lovely as the first night, cut the stone that built the pyramids. We have been here before. Our warriors faced the scourge and the might of the scorpion. We thwarted his dominion over Africa and reclaimed the ancient threads of our knowledge and gifts to humankind long before other conquerors came to our shores. We removed the barriers of ignorance and isolation. No people nor nation are the sole architects of their own lives or their own destinies. We told the seers and the high priests and the pharaohs, but they heeded not. We washed our wounds in the Nile. We danced in the streets of Egypt. We slept under the wings of the scarab. We made love to Nefertiti. Yes, look at us. We have been here before. Our eyes were stark black stars raging in the night, tempests of rebellion, ancient as life. long before the serpent came to our children in the garden, we looked at God and saw our image in his eyes. We have been here before. That's the poem.
Magnificent. Wow. Thank you so much. What a brilliant reading. With that, I think what I'm going to do is tie this up, because it's a perfect fit for the hour's format of our show. And I'm going to thank you so, so much for such a moving and powerful portrayal of your father and his work and his meaning. I'm so excited to have had this time with you.
Thank you.
No, thank you once again, Ted.
You've been listening to Raj Kanji in Canada here with Doug Miller, interviewing Dr. Teddy Matera about his late father, an activist, poet, a journalist that left a huge mark on South Africa when he passed away in July. And Gwen, what's coming up for next week?
Well, actually, I sat in on a webinar hosted by, or I guess I was told about it by an organization called A Growing Culture. And it is a webinar that involves a number of activists across the continent in Africa, taking on the whole notion of a green revolution, one that is fueled by chemicals and seed corporations and, you know, truly the most highly privatized and corporatized form of agriculture you could possibly imagine. So these activists are very, very eloquent in dismantling this model and looking at different ways to move forward in terms of establishing food security and autonomy in Africa. So we'll be listening to that next week. And also, Doug and I are thrilled to be able to say that in a couple of weeks, we'll actually be back in the studio.
Hooray!
For the first time in, I'm not even counting anymore how long it's been. So we're going to be thrilled to be able to bring you the show live from the studio in the next 2 or 3 weeks. But for now, that wraps it up for us in my kitchen, in Doug's living room, and we'll be back with you next week. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphoria.
Join Quebec Music Parallel for 3 straight nights of jazz and new music in Montreal. Tuesday, October 11th, the Yves Charuet Trio, along with Marianne Trudel and Karen Young at the Lion d'Or. Wednesday, October 12th, Plante with New Persons Les Oreilles and No High Banda at the Sala Rosa. Thursday, October 13th, Ivan Nonet and Mathieu Stallaire at Le Ministère. Tickets available on the venue websites, a CKUT co-presentation.
it doesn't. How sweet.
Abuse your speakers, lose your mind.